It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. As Wisconsin voters head to the polls today, we're checking in with a spokesman for the Elections Commission to help you figure out what you need and how to get where you need to go. Reid Magny represents the Wisconsin Elections Commission. The group administers and enforces the state's election laws. Do you have specific questions? We're taking your calls for a few minutes, 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Reid Magny, welcome back to the program.
Nice to be with you.
So I assume you're pretty busy today. Talk to us about what I need to do to vote today. What do I need to bring with me?
So if you're registered to vote, all you need to bring with you is a photo ID. Most people have the one they need, a driver license, a state ID card, a military ID, a passport, many student IDs, veterans IDs, tribal IDs. These all work. When you go to get your ballot, you're showing your ID to prove who you are, not where you live. So if you've moved and your address is old on your driver license, that's okay. As long as you've re-registered to vote at your new address, you're fine. If you're registering to vote, you need to additionally bring something known as a proof of residence document. It could be a utility bill, a tax bill. If your address on your ID is current, that's fine too.
But you can't bring a utility bill instead of a state ID.
No, your utility bill is used to prove where you live. Your state ID or driver license is to prove who you are.
I have a question here about with the protocol for absentee voting. Can we still absentee vote today?
No, the absentee, the last day to cast a ballot absentee in person in the clerk's office was last week. If you haven't returned your absentee ballot yet, you need to get it to your clerk's office as soon as possible so it can get out to the polling place. Today is the last day for the clerk to get absentee ballots back.
So if you have it, you can give it back. I'm told that, actually, I think you told me the last time we talked, that I can go and register to vote today at the polling place before casting my vote.
Absolutely. Wisconsin is one of the states that's for a long time had same-day voter registration. And again, you got to make sure that you bring a proof of residence document with you.
Okay, so say I moved and I don't know where necessarily my polling place is. How do I find out?
We have a great website. It's called myvote.wi.gov. Again, that's myvote.wi.gov. And you can find your polling place there. You can check on your registration by putting in your name and your birth date. It'll tell you whether you're registered or where you're registered. If you've moved since then, you can find your new polling place. And you can also see what's going to be on your ballot today, too. That's very helpful.
So let's talk about what's going to be on the ballot. Are there judges on the ballot?
No. Today's is a partisan primary. Judges in Wisconsin are nonpartisan, and this is a partisan primary, mostly for political offices. Mm-hmm. We're narrowing the field in the Democratic primary for governor. In the U.S. Senate, there's a Republican primary to see who will be the Republican nominee. There are also congressional primaries, especially in the 1st Congressional District, where Speaker Paul Ryan is retiring. There are legislative races all over. So there's a lot for people to vote on.
And do I have to vote for everybody? What if I just want to vote for my congressman and a gubernatorial candidate, and that's it? Does my ballot still count?
Absolutely. You can vote for as many or as few. I mean, if you don't want to vote for anyone, but you want to have known that you participated in the election, you can go in and get your ballot and put an empty ballot into the machine if that's really what you want to do. If you don't like anybody on the ballot, or if you want to vote for just one,
right,
that's fine too. The key is in these partisan primaries that you can only vote in one party's primary. Wisconsin is really great in that on election day you get to decide, today I'm a Republican, today I'm a Democrat, I'm a Green, I'm a Libertarian, I'm in the Constitution Party. But once you make that decision, you got to stay in that lane.
So this is really interesting. You have to stay in that lane. Voting in the general election, you can vote for anybody. But
absolutely.
What's interesting to me is that if there is a close race, say on the Democratic side, and the Republican opponent wants to run against one person on the Democratic side in this race, they and their supporters can go in and register as Democrats and vote for the guy that they want to run against.
Well, we don't register as anything here in Wisconsin.
Okay.
We're completely nonpartisan. We've been that way since the early 1900s. But, people can cross over if they want. However, if you're a Republican, do you want to go mess around in the Democratic primary, or would you rather choose your Republican U.S. Senate candidate? If you're a Democrat, do you want to really do the other thing? People have to decide really what where they think their vote will count the most. And I think most people vote for, in the primary that ideologically fits them. There are always going to be people who will vote in a different primary, but I don't think that's a big deal.
Okay. So the polls close tonight at 8. If there are people still standing in line, it's a primary. I know it's unlikely to happen, but if there are people still standing in line, do they get in after 8?
Absolutely. If you're in line at 8 o'clock, you get to vote.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about hacking. You and I talked about this before when you were on. People are concerned about this. Wisconsin prints out the ballot, so you can double check what you just voted for. Correct?
Right. So, 85% of the people in Wisconsin are going to get a paper ballot that you either fill in an oval or complete an arrow, and that goes into a machine. 5% cast a ballot on paper that is actually going to be hand counted tonight. Then there's 10% that vote on what's known as a touchscreen voting machine, and that machine has a paper like a cash register tape inside, and when you make your selections, I'm going to vote for George Washington, I'm going to vote for Abraham Lincoln, you can see that printing on the tape, and if the tape it correctly prints what you want, then you hit confirm, and then your vote is registered. And in the event of a recount or any questions or an audit or anything like that, it's what's on the tape that counts, not in the electronic memory.
So I want to talk about what you can say or wear to the polling place. Can you wear clothes that say the name of a candidate or cause you support?
You probably should not. And the reason that I hedge on that a little bit is there have been some Supreme Court decisions recently, like in Minnesota. Minnesota had a law that really restricted what people could wear. And, it was down to some of those, don't tread on me T-shirts and other things like that that could have some political implications, but we're not specifically saying, vote for Jones or...
But didn't the Supreme Court say that that law was not constitutional, or did I get that mixed up?
And now Wisconsin doesn't have a law that specifically says you can't wear shirts or hats with candidates' names to the polling place. What we have are laws against electioneering, which means that within 100 feet of the entrance to the polling place, you can't have signs, you can't have brochures, you can't have other things supporting candidates, and that includes, apparel. But we're in a little bit of a gray area, but our best advice to people is leave your political items at home, when you go. And then afterward, you can go home and put on your shirt or put on your hat leave your hat in your car if you're going to
vote. Reed Magny represents the Wisconsin Elections Commission. The group administers and enforces the state's election laws. Thanks for joining us, Reed.
You're welcome.
Next up, we're going to look at affordable housing and what that really means. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. 25 years ago, you could find a decent one-bedroom apartment in Milwaukee or Madison for under $500. Today, that same apartment is three times as much, at least. But minimum wage has not gone up since that time, really. So how do people making minimum wage, or even just above that, afford housing for their families? Our guest today says they don't. Diane Yentl is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Her group put out a study, Out of Reach, the High Cost of Housing, earlier this summer. Diane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
So what was the goal of this study? Is this the first one you've ever done?
No, actually, this was the 29th year.
Ah, there you go.
Out of Reach, yeah. And the goal of it is always to educate the public and policymakers about the gap between what people are earning and what it costs to rent a decent apartment.
So when was the last time minimum wage was raised?
Oh, it's been many, many years. And even just by cost, by the inflation rate, it continues to actually lose value over time.
And where did you get the data for this report?
Well, the data comes from the HUD's fair market rents, which are the Department of Housing and Urban Development's kind of best estimate of what a family moving today can expect to pay for a modest rental home. And we look also at the fair market rents is typically the 40th percentile of rents that a family can expect to pay. So we base on the fair market rent, estimating that a household would pay no more than 30% of their income towards their housing costs, which is what experts agree. I mean, none of us should be paying more than 30% of our income towards our housing costs. And when we put that together, we come up with what we call the housing wage, that is, how much somebody has to earn an hour working full-time in order to rent a modest home, paying no more than 30% of their income towards their rent.
And how much?
So this year, in 2018, the national housing wage nationally is $22.10 an hour to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment, and about $18 an hour to afford a one-bedroom apartment. So there's actually no state, no metro area, no county, even those where the minimum wage has been set above the federal level, where a minimum wage worker working 40 hours a week can afford a modest two-bedroom rental unit. And, in fact, in just 22 out of 3,000 counties nationwide can they afford a modest one-bedroom apartment.
We are talking about affordable housing, especially if you make minimum wage. We're taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Diane, you've been doing this study for 29 years. Has anybody been listening to you in government?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I think we're seeing that certainly the housing crisis is intensifying. We've reached historic heights at this point, and it's most negatively impacting the lowest income people. I think that increased need and severity of the crisis is getting the attention of policymakers more and more because they're hearing more and more from their constituents that housing costs are out of reach for them. So I do think we're starting to see more of an urgency around putting forward big, bold ideas, and we're starting to see a willingness to invest in the solutions to make homes affordable for the lowest income people.
We're going to get to solutions.
But we still have a long way to go.
Okay, so we're going to get to solutions in a minute. I want to get back to this report. Give us a range here. What is the highest wage a renter would need to be able to pay their rent in, say, Chicago, as opposed to Kansas City, as opposed to Phoenix?
Well, the highest housing wage in the country is in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
It's over $60 an hour in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment there. In Wisconsin, the housing wage is quite a bit lower than San Francisco, for sure, and even lower than the national housing wage. State of Wisconsin, the housing wage is about $16.52 an hour for that two-bedroom apartment. But even in Wisconsin, there's a range. So Madison, Minneapolis have significantly higher housing wages, closer to $21 an hour, whereas Milwaukee, Kenosha County, Columbia County, also higher than the state average, Their housing wage is around $1,750 an hour for that two-bedroom apartment.
So in the urban areas, it costs more. Are there places in urban areas that cost a lot less, and the average kind of averages out because there are wealthier people there?
Typically, the urban areas have the higher housing wages. But I think the thing that's important to recognize is that the balance or the gap between the wages and the housing costs remains about the same throughout the country. So even in the rural areas where the housing wage might be lower, typically, you know, the housing costs are lower, the housing wages might be lower, but there's still that gap between what they can afford and what the rents actually cost.
Because they're making less money.
Exactly.
So how many people are we talking about here in the U.S. that actually struggle to pay the rent in this way?
Well, one way we look at how are people struggling to pay the rent is, are they what's called cost burdened? So are they paying more than 30% of their income towards their rent each month? Another way to look at it is looking at whether people are what's called severely cost burdened. In other words, they're paying more than 50% of their income towards their rent each month. And in the case of severely cost-burdened renters, there's more than 11 million households throughout the country that are in that situation today. And, of course, there's hundreds of thousands more that have no homes at all. So those extremely low-income households who are paying half of their income towards rent each month, you know, they're facing housing instability. They're, you know, one illness, one divorce, one paycheck away from not being able to pay the rent and facing potential eviction and homelessness. And in the meantime, they're having to make really tough trade-offs between, you know, paying the rent or buying the medication they need. Or
groceries.
The rent or, right, buying the healthy food for their kids.
And are these people, first of all, 11 million seems low to me in some way. I feel like I've seen 11 million people dealing with this in Chicago alone.
Uh-huh. Well, it depends on how you're measuring it. The severe cost burdened, if we're looking at extremely low-income households, so, you know, these are seniors, they're people with disabilities, they're families with kids, and they're working really low-wage jobs, there's about 8 million extremely low-income households nationally that are severely cost-burdened. There's nearly 10 million that are cost-burdened. In other words, they're paying more than 30%. And then when you go up the income scale, it's a decreasing number of people that are facing those severe cost burdens. But even when you look at people who are very low-income, you know, there's about 5 million that are cost-burdened. People who are low-income, there's another 4 million. So when you add up the income ladder, it does increase in number.
And so we're talking about can you pay your rent or do you have to buy groceries and the choices that you have to make. Are the people who you're talking about eligible for SNAP benefits?
Yeah, some of them are. Some of them receive other benefits as well. But they're so low-income. If you're talking about a household that is, let's say, senior or has a disability and they're on a fixed income, they're getting SSI disability insurance or something like that, they're earning somewhere around $10,000 to $12,000 a year. So even with additional benefits that they might receive elsewhere, with housing costs being as high as they are, they still can't afford the rent.
And we're talking usually one-income family. What if we have two incomes in a family?
Similarly, so sometimes we get that question about, you know, why are we talking about two-bedroom apartments? Why not? Would a single person try to rent a two-bedroom apartment? The two-bedroom apartments we look at, they're the most common rental home size, and the data from those two-bedroom apartments are the most reliable. Mm. But certainly, and single-wage earner families with children need at least those two bedrooms. But if you look at the number of hours that a minimum wage worker or even, you know, an average renter would have to work an hour, it's often multiple jobs to be able to make those ends meet. And even two jobs in many cases isn't enough. So at the national level where we have the housing wage is over $22 an hour to afford that two-bedroom apartment, a minimum wage worker, and you know these are they're child care workers, they're nurses' assistants, they're right. emergency medical technicians, right? The people we rely on and interact with every day in our community, they'd have to work $122 hours a week for 52 weeks of the year, which is three full time jobs, to afford that modest two bedroom apartment, and they'd have to work nearly 100 hours a week, or 2.5 full time jobs, to afford a modest one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah, so if we're talking about that, if we're talking about the housing wage being $22 nationally, $21 in the urban areas of Wisconsin, and $7.25 is the minimum wage, even if you do have two people working, they're not making that 20. They're making about $15 an hour, a little less than $15 an hour at the same time. So, my question here is that policymakers are looking at this?
Policymakers are looking at it to different degrees in different areas. You know, there's a whole host of solutions that are necessary, right? Federal, state, and local policy makers have a role to play.
Okay, we're going to get to that in a moment. We are talking to Diane Yentl. She is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She stays with us as we consider solutions to the high cost of housing. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Minimum wage does not buy you minimum housing in most of the U.S. This adds to the homeless population. It also wreaks havoc with schools in low-income areas, as many students move around and have to restart at different schools year after year. Diane Yentl of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition is taking us through how this works, or doesn't in this case. Her group put out the study, Out of Reach, the High Cost of Housing, earlier this summer. We're taking your calls on this. Are you having trouble making ends meet? Is housing costing you too much? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Now, Diane, we left talking about policy. Specifically, do you know what we are considering here in Wisconsin?
Well, the thing about the housing crisis, especially when it comes to looking at the lowest income people, is that there's essentially a market failure there. Developers can't build and operate homes, rental homes, that are affordable for the lowest income people, because the amount that they can afford to pay for rent doesn't cover the cost of operating that home. So that's basic market failure. And that's where the government needs to step in to correct for a market failure. And the scale of investment necessary to solve this crisis for the lowest income people is really the federal government's responsibility. There are a number of federal housing programs that serve low-income people, about 5 million people today who get federal housing assistance. It helps them afford their homes, pay the rent each month. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the needs of many more families go unmet. And we actually have a housing system today where just one in every four low-income people who need housing assistance and are eligible to get it receives any. So about 75% of the people who need housing assistance, they don't get any at all. They're the ones who are adding their names to, you know, years or decades-long waiting lists, mm-hmm. hoping to win this housing lottery.
Right.
So what's most needed is for the federal government to fund the solutions at the scale necessary, even at the scale like we used to, like the federal government used to decades ago, and at a time when we actually had a surplus of homes affordable and available to the lowest income people back at a time when we were funding the solutions at the scale necessary. So that's what's most important.
Okay, so wait a second. Talk to me about that time when we were funding these solutions. When was that?
If you'd have to go back to the late 70s to find a time when there was actually the homelessness that exists in our country today didn't exist back then.
Okay.
Having, you know, people living on the streets and in shelters and in their cars, that's a modern phenomenon that was created through budget cuts, really, that started in the late 70s and early 80s. So in the late 70s, we had President Nixon established a moratorium on building any new deeply affordable apartments through public housing or other programs like that. We stopped building those units back in the late 70s. And then in the early 80s, President Reagan slashed the budget for the Department of Housing and Urban Development he slashed it by about half, and he deeply cut programs that served the lowest income people. So since that time, we've had some new federal housing programs created, but none have been funded at the scale that they were back then, and none have been as deeply targeted to the lowest income people as they were back then. So back then, we actually had a surplus of apartments that were affordable for the lowest income people. Today, nationally, there's a shortage of over 7 million affordable homes for those lowest income people.
So you're saying this very clearly, that it were political decisions in the 80s made the homeless population swell.
Absolutely. I mean, it was only years after the HUD budget was cut to the degree that it was that we suddenly had to have a new influx of federal resources, of investments into shelters and into all of the other expenses that come when people are homeless or when they're severely cost burdened.
And this costs us more or less than what we were spending just helping people find housing through HUD in the 80s?
Yeah, great question. It costs us far more today. Homelessness is far more expensive to us as a country. I mean, not even to speak, of course, of the expense to those families and to the children and to their futures. But just looking in a purely economic sense, we spend far more when people are homeless than we would otherwise to keep them housed. There was a study recently that came out from Children's Health Watch, a group of pediatricians out of Boston, that showed that as a country, over 10 years, we'll spend $111 billion in avoidable health care costs because people are unstably housed or homeless. Hmm. So if we were to spend that money instead on housing people, we would actually save money in the health care system.
Okay, so you run the National Low Income Housing Coalition. I am sure you've had people say to you, why don't these people just get better jobs? Why don't these people just get educated? What do you say to that?
Yeah, we do hear that often, and I'd say a few things about that. One is that we're all impacted. When people are unable to afford their homes, it creates a downward spiral for an entire community. And the costs, as I was just saying, the healthcare sector is one example of where we as a country overspend in order to make up for the fact that we're not assisting people afford their homes in the first place. But there's so much research to show really just how central housing affordability is to the outcomes of so many other sectors and so many other aspects of all of our lives. So when people are affordably housed, they are healthier. Their kids do better in school. They earn more over their lifetime. They even live longer. So affordable housing in the community assists those individual families and those kids, but it also makes the entire community healthier, and we save money as a federal government. We also just have to recognize the way our economy works and that we have very low-wage workers. And even when we successfully increase minimum wage in some communities throughout the country, even when that occurs, still the housing costs are too high. There's a disconnect. It's not that people aren't working hard enough. Mm-hmm. It's that wages don't pay enough to cover the costs of housing. It's an issue, too, I should say, you know, not just for minimum wage workers. The average renter in the country earns about $17 an hour, which is, you know, about $5 less than that two-bedroom apartment costs. So that average renter earns enough to afford a two-bedroom apartment in just 11% of U.S. counties, and they can afford a one-bedroom apartment in half of U.S. counties. So people are working, and they're working very often very hard. The housing costs exceed what they can afford, and that's not even to speak of seniors and people with disabilities who may not be able to work and are on very limited incomes, and the housing costs are far out of reach for them.
Okay, we're going to get to that disconnect in a second. I want to take a John from Three Lakes. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, I was just wondering, you had mentioned a couple of the cities that were having problems, San Francisco, Chicago. Can you name a couple of the other ones?
Well, the thing about the housing crisis, and especially for the lowest income people, is that it exists everywhere in the country. So one way we look at the crisis is we actually quantify the shortage of homes that are affordable and available for the lowest income people. So nationally, there's a shortage of over 7 million homes for those lowest income people. Another way of looking at that is for every 100 of the lowest income people, there are just 35 homes that are affordable and available to them. Mm. Now, there's some places that have a more severe shortage. Wisconsin is one of them. Texas, Florida, Colorado, California, all of them have shortages even more severe. So in Wisconsin, for every 100 of the lowest income people, there's just 28 homes that are affordable and available. But even when you look at rural communities or communities that are not on the coast, so Kansas, Missouri, Arkansas, Minnesota, Alabama, all of them have less than half of the homes necessary for all of the low-income people who need them. So it's really a pervasive crisis that exists in big cities, in suburbs, and in rural areas across the country.
Thank you very much, John. Rural areas across the country, are rural areas facing this harder? Or are they better off, perhaps?
Well, again, it's relative, right? I'd say that rural areas, so for example, let's say in Mississippi, for every 100 of those lowest income people who need an affordable home, there's just 57 homes that are affordable and available. So that's less severe than in Wisconsin, where there's less than 30 homes, mm-hmm. but it's still quite a significant shortage of homes. And even in those rural areas, you can find that housing costs are significantly at times less than what housing costs in the big cities, but people are also paid less in those communities. So the difference, the idea of people moving to, very poor people just moving someplace in order to find housing that's affordable to them, we find that for the lowest income people, those places where they can afford the rent just don't exist.
And they can't afford to move. I mean, that's the other part, is that to move would create even a bigger burden on them and their housing needs.
Sure, there's a lot of expenses associated with moving, and also moving away from maybe social support networks that make life possible when you are so poor and having such a difficult time making ends meet.
We are talking to Diane Yentel of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. We're talking about the difference between the disconnect between what people make and what people need to pay for affordable housing. We're going to be back with Diane in a moment. It's the Morning Show. The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Housing prices have risen in the last couple of generations, but incomes have really not. So more people can't afford homes for themselves or for their families. According to the study, Out of Reach, the High Cost of Housing, we are talking to Diane Yentel, who is the author of that study, and she runs the Affordable Housing Coalition. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Diane, I want to talk a little bit more about this disconnect that we see here. Is there a greater disconnect in different states? And I'm talking specifically red states, blue states. Does California do this better than, say, Mississippi?
No, again, in terms of the shortage for the lowest income people exists at
everywhere.
Different scales, but pretty significantly in Mississippi and in California. There's definitely differences in how the housing crisis sort of looks and feels and what the specific local solutions could be in different communities. So California is a good example of a state where the local zoning laws are so restrictive that in many communities, any kind of multifamily developments or apartments aren't being built. And so even at the higher income levels, the supply is not nearly keeping up with the demand for apartments, which is leading to really high housing costs. That's an example of where local communities have an important role to play in looking at their zoning laws and finding ways to ensure that apartments are being built at all income levels to meet the demand that exists. That will relieve some of the upper pressure on costs for higher income people in the rental market. It still won't alleviate the needs of the lowest income renters. That's where the federal government has an important role to play in investing in the solutions there. But cities and states certainly have an important role to play in looking at local zoning and looking at ways to increase state and local resources for some of the housing solutions to build more apartments affordable for low-income people or create rental assistance for low-income people.
We are taking calls today, 800-642-1234. You still have a few minutes left. Jeremy from Racine, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I recently just read a book named Evicted. It pretty much bases stories of families here in Milwaukee, southern Milwaukee, and the perpetual problems dealing with evictions for low-income individuals is pretty bad. Milwaukee has a law, ordinances for nuisance tenants. So if you have a tenant who calls the police department on several occasions throughout a month or any given period of time on a domestic problem, they basically put pressure on landlords to rectify the situation. In most cases, they just evict everybody from the property.
Hmm.
And once you get an eviction on that individual, it's incredibly hard for them to find a new place to live in because they have a permanent record of an eviction. So, I mean, there's a lot of laws, I think, on the books that can deal with a lot of evictions, homelessness that's within city of Milwaukee or throughout the country in general, laws that are more, seems like to be catered to the landowners more so than the tenants. And tenants tend to fear to hold their landlords accountable for things for the fear of being put back out on the street.
That's interesting. Thank you very much, Jeremy. So how do you speak to that, Diane? Go ahead.
It's a great point, Jeremy, and thanks for raising it. And Evicted is a terrific book if any of your readers haven't read it and are looking for a way to really understand the housing crisis and how it's impacting people in your communities. I highly recommend reading Evicted. Matt Desmond's done really important work with that. And one of the things, exactly as Jeremy noted, that I think the book helped bring to light is this challenge with nuisance laws. It's, you can imagine how it would be particularly challenging for people who are suffering from domestic abuse, who then fear, as he said, calling the police because it could result in their own eviction, and then all of the challenges that arise from that. So there are some communities that are starting to look at the challenge with nuisance laws and to overturn them. There's also challenges with in eviction court. There's a very high number of tenants who go to eviction court without any lawyers, where their landlords certainly have very good lawyers. And so there are an increasing interest among local communities. New York City was the first to pass a law that is a right to counsel law that provides all tenants who go to eviction court with an attorney to help defend them. Another example of a local law that can have a real impact on people's ability to get into homes they can afford is something that's called source of income discrimination. So landlords can sometimes reject tenants who have federal rental assistance in the form of a Section 8 voucher, and they can reject them because they have a voucher. So then they struggle to be able to find apartments where they can use that rental assistance. So increasingly communities are looking at banning source of income discrimination. So Jeremy's absolutely right. There's a number of really important ways that cities, counties, and states can pass laws to make the whole atmosphere of renting in that community easier and more just for low-income people.
You know, we actually had a caller or somebody tweeting us, Katie from Madison, talking about how low-income housing, and I'm assuming that that she includes in their Section 8 housing, affects neighborhoods. Does it attract people? Is there a correlation between the people who come with Section 8 vouchers and crime?
No, actually, that's been pretty well debunked by research that shows that there is no correlation between Section 8 voucher holders moving into a community and any increased crime. The challenge that we find with Section 8 voucher holders actually often is that the way that the rents are set at the federal level often requires them to continue living in poor and often segregated communities rather than allowing them the opportunity to move into communities that maybe have better schools or less crime or access to transportation and jobs. So there are some changes that are being considered at the federal level to make the worth of those vouchers high enough that low-income tenants could be able to move into those so-called higher opportunity neighborhoods to have all the amenities and access to opportunity that they offer.
So there are two bills before Congress right now, the Rent Relief Act and the Home Act. Tell us what they would do.
Sure. So those are two recent bills that were introduced by Senator Kamala Harris from California, introduced the Rent Relief Act, and Senator Booker introduced the Home Act. Both of them would create a new renter's tax credit. They have slightly different ways of going about it, but essentially it would assist people who are cost-burdened, who are paying more than 30% of their income towards their rent. It would provide a tax credit to cover the burden, that cost burden, between what they're paying, the burden itself, they're paying over 30% of their income towards their rent, up to a fair market rent, and they cap the fair market rent differently. But basically, it would put money back in the pockets of low-income people who are struggling to afford their rent. And Senator Booker's bill also includes a really important provision that gets at that inclusive zoning policies that I was talking about earlier, and it would require states and local communities to look at their zoning policies and create more inclusive zoning policies that increase the affordable housing supply overall.
We have been talking to Diane Yentel. She is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She put out the 29th. This is your 29th year putting out this study?
Yeah, that's right.
The 29th year, Out of Reach, the High Cost of Housing. This came out earlier this summer. Diane, in 20 seconds, are you hopeful that this will get solved in your lifetime?
I am absolutely hopeful. The thing about the affordable housing solution is that we have the data, we have the resources, we have the solutions. We lack only the political will to fund those solutions at the scale necessary, and together we're working to build that political will. So, yes, we can solve this crisis if we choose to.
Thanks for being with us, Diane.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.